I love getting lost in the stories of cinema. The famous American film critic Roger Ebert, he described cinema as a machine for generating empathy. And I think that's such an interesting way to describe what's going on both on the screen but in the heads and hearts of the people who are viewing it. And one of the most common storytelling moves is a sort of fall from stature, when a character goes from a place of power and influence to a place of poverty and powerlessness. I'm thinking of old classics. Anybody like Ben-Hur, the old one, the good one, Charlton Heston? Yeah, absolutely. The title character goes through a series of misunderstandings, and he goes from being a wealthy and influential Jewish man living in Roman Palestine to a slave, a prisoner whose only job day in and day out is to row that oar in the naval ship. Then, of course, he rescues the proconsul and the tides change once again. But you'll have to watch the movie to find out what happens. Stories like this remind me, and they remind us, of how fragile identity can be and how unexpected its rebuilding can look. And we've seen something a bit like that in Moses' life last week. He was a prince in Egypt. He had almost unparalleled power and influence, and while he and we as readers know that he was actually an Israelite, to any of the outsiders, he was simply part of the Egyptian royal court. And then, of course, in an outburst of anger at the injustice facing his own people, he kills an Egyptian overseer who was roughing up an Israelite. Within 24 hours, his whole world changes. And he sets off to the desert. He ends up in Midian, where he gets married to Zipporah, the daughter of a shepherd and priest. And according to the later historical tradition in Acts chapter 7, the story picking up in chapter 3 takes place some 40 years later. So 40 years have gone by from what we talked about last week, and you can picture Moses maybe looking very different from the man we saw in Egypt. The fine clothing is gone, replaced by the ragged clothes that shepherds wore to protect them from the elements. There's no more fine grooming, fine dining, or the pampering of his days in Egypt. Instead of royal banquets, he shares his meals with sheep. Instead of a palace, he has a wilderness. It's quite realistic to think that his friends back in Egypt probably wouldn't recognize him. And it's at this point when anybody would probably assume that's how the rest of their life was going to continue, that Moses has an encounter that would change his life trajectory forever. So I'm going to invite Nick up, and he's going to read the first part of our passage this morning from Exodus chapter 3.
Page 59, I think, in the church Bibles. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, Here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites have reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now Go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?
Cheers. The passage starts with such an interesting way. We can imagine our former prince, now 40 years older, a bit grizzled, smelling like sheep, leading animals through a wilderness. It's worth saying Horeb is not really near Midian, so most historians think that this was because he's leading his sheep onto a particularly nice grassy region somewhere on the opposite side of this mountain range. And it's in this journey that he sees an unexpected sight, a bush that's on fire but not consumed. I think it's fair to assume that Moses, who's been shepherding for decades now, he would know what the deal was with brush fires. He's seen these kinds of things. So why is he so intrigued by this one? Now, I think a little story might help. Some of you know we moved to Edinburgh just a week before Christmas in 2023. There's boxes to unpack, presents still to buy. We didn't have a Christmas tree. So Hannah and child one went to Dobby's pronunciation, the day before Christmas Eve to see if there were any trees left. And sure enough, they spotted this lovely little potted tree. It had a big red bow on it, which child one liked, and it had a 50% off sticker because it was the day before Christmas Eve, which Hannah liked, and they somehow managed to stuff the thing in the car, and we put a single run of tinsel on it, and that was our tree, our first Christmas up in Edinburgh. And I should say it was a little guy. It's potted. We had the admirable goal. We said, well, what we're going to do once Christmas is over, we're going to take it out in the garden, we're going to plant it, and we're going to take pictures next to it every Christmas, and this is going to be this lovely, you know, little moment. But of course, one thing leads to another. Another Saturday rolls around, and I look out in the January weather, and I think, I can't plant that tree. And February rolls around, I notice it's blown over, and I don't know when it blew over, but it's starting to look rather brown. So I thought, yeah. So a couple weeks later, the nephews and I are having a bonfire, and I think to myself, I can get rid of that tree carcass. And so I brought it near to the fire, and I'm getting it out of the pot, and I'm just about to pop it in. And even getting close to our tiny little bonfire, next thing you know, it went, if you've ever lit a old Christmas tree on fire, it's like napalm. I nearly singed my beard as I was chucking it in there. And unfortunately, just as this was happening, child one I didn't see was behind me, and she just whispered, my tree. And I quietly judged myself as a parent. Now, the point here, as I discovered, is Moses would have known, as a much more outdoorsy guy than I am, that bushes, shrubs, they burn quickly. They go like that. They're gone. What we've got in this chapter is something that's burning without stopping. It's noteworthy. It's the kind of thing that would cause a man who's got lots of animals who need to be fed to stop and change course. And you can imagine how much more the tone changes, of course, when he hears a voice talking to him. Moses hears a voice calling his name and telling him to take his shoes off. Why this little anecdote about the shoes? So in many ancient cultures, and indeed throughout the Bible, and even today, there's a pattern where people would remove their shoes before entering the home, the tent, or the palace of a person who is superior to them. And it's a practical thing, right? The important person doesn't want people tracking in any sand, dirt, or worse, into their nice carpets. But here, in the middle of the desert, this represents something even bigger. One, God doesn't have a house. Everything is his. And two, Moses taking off his sandals demonstrates his deep respect for God and God's authority. He knows into whose presence he's come. This was God showing him that all ground is God's ground and that his holiness transforms ordinary wilderness into a holy space. And it's worth a brief aside to soak in how significant this encounter is. It's been hundreds of years since God has spoken to humans. In fact, the last time God spoke was in a vision to Jacob, Joseph's father. Think about it. Generation after generation of God's people had lived and died in Egypt without hearing God's voice. And then suddenly, in the wilderness, God speaks again. There's something so powerful here. Moses would have grown up around a bunch of idols within the Egyptian religion, but none of them would have ever actually done or said anything. They sat mute and still on the shelves while people worshiped them out of routine and out of fear. Now contrast that with a fire that's constant. It's raging. You can hear it. It's lighting up the night sky. You can feel the heat burning off it in the dark desert. But now, of course, we need to actually dig into what God actually says. And we can boil God's message to Moses down to a few points. Ultimately, God has seen the misery of his people. He cares about them. He's going to rescue them. And he's going to bring them to a good and spacious land. And if you're Moses right now, you must be thinking, amazing. God's going to save the day. He's going to put things right. This is awesome. And then we get to verse 10. So now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Now, it's not in the passage, but I think we can imagine there's a sizable gulp moment for Moses here. A few things to remember. He left Egypt as a fugitive on the run from the law. He's not innocent of crime either. There's good reason for him to be arrested and maybe even executed just for crossing the border back into Egypt. But there's more. Moses is likely around 80 years old just now. He's not the sort of figure to inspire fear into the heart of someone like an Egyptian pharaoh. He doesn't look like a figure of power and authority. I mean, he could probably walk up a broken escalator, but in a world where physical presence has a significant effect, Moses isn't the sort of person you expect to either lead people or to negotiate with a world leader. And to some extent, he points out his shortcomings to God. He says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? Will the Israelites listen to me? Who on earth do I tell them sent me? Now, it's worth saying that these ring true. He's an unlikely leader, to say the least. He's not someone you'd vote for or follow into battle, and yet God's chosen him. God's going to work in him, work through him. He's going to shape him up, and he's going to bring the right people alongside him. And to be very clear, it doesn't mean that Moses will get some sort of holy dust sprinkled on him and become the best religious and political leader in history. He's still himself. But God is working out his plan in his way and in his timing. And maybe this is a place where you can sympathize a bit with Moses. I'm not the best person, place to be a force for good in my workplace, in my school. When someone asks me what I believe, I have no idea what to say. I just stand there. I wait for a hole in the ground to swallow me up. If that's you, stay tuned. And I'm going to invite Nick back up because I want to see what God continues to say to Moses in the second part of this chapter. So we're going to pick up at verse 11.
Page 60 in the church Bibles from verse 11, yeah. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name you shall call me from generation to generation. Go, assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you and have seen what has been done to you in Egypt, and I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. The elders of Israel will listen to you. Then you and the elders are to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. After that, he will let you go, and I will make the Egyptians favorably disposed towards his people, so that when you leave, you will not go empty-handed. Every woman is to ask her neighbor and any woman living in her house for articles of silver and gold and for clothing, which you will put on your sons and daughters, and so you will plunder the Egyptians.
Thank you. Again, Nick. Cheers. Getting extra step count in today. Appreciate that. You see, Moses' hang-ups and fears about what God's asked him to do are kind of summarized in two questions, two responses that he gives. He says, who am I to go and tell Pharaoh what to do? And he says, who should I tell the Israelites has sent me? And in the time we have left, I want to look at what God does with these two objections. I want to look at them in reverse order. We'll start with what's going on with God revealing his name. And then we'll look at Moses' self-doubts. So what is the big deal with God revealing his name? In the ancient world, there were lots of gods kicking about. The common practice was for societies to have multiple gods, one for rain, one for life, one for death, these sorts of things. And the distinction, of course, for the people of Israel is that they worship one God, not many gods. So then, why would Moses revealing God's name, I am who I am, be any encouragement to the Israelites? Why would this change anything? This goes in part to the way that the Israelites talk about God. They use different names for God throughout the Bible. This may sound a bit nerdy, but I promise it's important. Now, the word Elohim, which is the top one there, is what is used throughout the chapter thus far. It's essentially the generic Hebrew word for God, to the extent that if the Israelites were talking about gods of other religions, they would just use that word, God with a small g. Then we have the most holy, most sacred name that the Israelites use for God, which is Yahweh, which is at the bottom there. We could say I am, is what it means. This name is so special that most Jewish people today won't actually say it out loud. Our English Bibles are actually really helpful. If a passage is using Yahweh, they'll typically translate it Lord, all capital. Now, Yahweh means I am. This isn't the first time it pops up in the Bible, by the way. It's used throughout Genesis and actually in Exodus prior to this chapter. So it's not that God is revealing this word for the first time here. What's different is that this is the first place he's showing them what the name means for them. In saying, I am who I am, God is setting out a crucial element of his nature, the fullness of his self-existence. Let me unpack what I mean by that. We are relational buildings, and we sometimes change or transform in relation to those who are around us. I'm sure there are people you've met where you think, I can really be myself with that person. And likewise, there will be others where you only might open up a little bit. You might be a bit more guarded. The way you present yourself changes in relation to others. Now, God is saying that he exists perfectly within himself. He doesn't change in the ways that we do. That doesn't mean that he's not relational. It means that he chooses to relate to us because he loves us. And on the basis of God's self-existence, he's revealing something of his presence and his faithfulness to his people. You see, you could actually translate this phrase not simply to read, I am, but I always will be. God's very name, the thing that they've been worshiping and saying in worship since the days of Abraham, is actually their most powerful reminder that he's with them, that he loves them, that he always will care for them. And this language is picked up later in the Bible masterfully in John's gospel in particular. John captures the absolute scandal of Jesus deliberately using the name I am in his teaching. He says, before Abraham was, I am. You can imagine how powerful and encouraging this was for his followers and how enraging it was to those who didn't follow him. You see, the voice at the bush is the same voice. It's Jesus all along who's moving his Father's plan forward in God's world. And we're going to wrap up. And as I do, I want to look finally at Moses' question of, who am I? It's one we may well ask ourselves on a fairly regular basis. Am I really the person God's going to use in this situation? I don't think I am. And look at what God doesn't say to Moses. Moses says, who am I to do this? He doesn't do what we might be tempted to do. He doesn't say, look, Moses, you're a great guy. You've moved on from all that bad stuff in Egypt. You've got great gifts. I just know you're going to do well. He doesn't fill him up with a bunch of platitudes. He doesn't talk about Moses at all. His reply begins by simply and profoundly stating what? I will be with you. Moses' credentials don't come into it. God's chosen him, and that's that. There's an old saying, I think it's echoed through so many pulpits, I have no idea who originally said it, but it goes like this. God doesn't call the qualified, he qualifies the called. And that's what we're going to see in the rest of our study in Exodus. God hasn't picked Moses on the basis of his stellar career choices, his speaking ability, or his vast social network. God's called him because he is going to do work in and through Moses to bring about his purposes and his plan. And Moses has no idea how that's going to happen. That's kind of the point. He has to rely in complete faith that God would do what he said he would do. And God's answer to Moses' question of who am I comes in four anchor points. You can look at these later if you want. It's his presence, I will be with you, verse 12. His promise, this good and spacious land he's going to lead the people to. It's going to come through people, elders who will listen, the help of his brother, Aaron. Moses is not going to be a solo act. And God's provision and God's power. God knows Pharaoh's going to say no. He tells him this from the beginning. But God also says that he's going to act powerfully. We saw that time and time again in our time in Matthew's gospel, didn't we? The disciples aren't exactly the most qualified bunch either. They get lots of things wrong, but nevertheless, they're the people that Jesus drew to himself, and they were the people who would eventually bring the good news about Jesus to the wider world. We are here because of their faithfulness, and they've given us a model. If God is at work in us, he's called us. He's not called us to hang out in a building and sing songs and drink coffee and eat home baking. He's called us to love him with our whole hearts, to love our neighbors as ourselves, and crucially, to share the hope that we have. We are the ones who have found hope, not from literal slavery like the Egyptians in Egypt, but from slavery to sin. And that doesn't mean we're perfect. Neither were the Israelites. We'll see that too. But what it does mean is that the same God who drew us to himself is going to work in and through us to accomplish his work in us and in this city. Two questions, and we're done. To those of you who are followers of Jesus, do you feel a bit like Moses sometimes? Are you feeling particularly unfit to be part of God's mission in this world, in your workplace, in your school? Well, good. So is virtually every person in the Bible. You're in good company. Don't waste the opportunities that lie before you in your friendships. share your hope. You can pray, Lord, I don't feel able, but I know you are. Please remind me that you're with me. And if you're not someone who would say that you're following Jesus, thank you for listening this far. Are you relying on your own name, on your own credentials, when God has actually reached out to you and offered you his in Jesus? What would it mean to be a part of God's family in that way? Do you feel like you might be in a bit of a spiritual wilderness? Ask God to make himself known to you. And as always, we'd love the opportunity to chat further about this if you have questions. I'm going to do something slightly different as musicians come back up. I want to pray a blessing over us as we close. May the Lord, the I Am, who was and is to come, go before us, stand beside us, and dwell within us. May his presence steady our steps, his promise guide our work. May we strengthen one another's hearts, and may his power supply all that we lack. In Jesus' name, amen. And powerlessness, and I'm thinking of old classes.